Hey, it's Jacob Goldstein from Business History. In our new series, American Genius, we tell the stories of three great writers who changed the way business works in America. Our first episode is about Benjamin Franklin, who, among many other things, was a best-selling business writer. Take a listen.
He's writing this much later in his life, consciously creating this image of himself. And I do want to emphasize how unusual this model is at the time, this self-made man myth, because you don't want to be self-made. It's low class to be self-made. You know, this idea that we have today is the opposite, right? And it comes from Franklin. Today, there is the derisive term nepo baby.
Well, exactly right. And these days, if you are a billionaire, you had better have a Benjamin Franklin story about starting in a garage, coming up with the idea from nothing.
And here is Benjamin Franklin inventing it right before our eyes.
This has been brought to you by Odoo. To listen to more of our American Genius series, listen to Business History. New episodes release every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including Live Dealer, Blackjack, and Craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
So what if the person who killed your spouse walked free and you got locked up instead? That's the real life nightmare that Gilbert King takes us into with Bone Valley, and even more in Bone Valley Season 2, a true crime podcast that unpacks the story of Leo Schofield, who's been in prison for over three decades for the 1987 murder of his wife, Michelle, a crime he says he didn't commit. The twist? There's a guy with a criminal record and a confession whose fingerprints were found on the victim's car, and yet somehow it's still Leo doing the time. Gilbert King, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and the man who cracked this case wide open, is joining us today to walk us through the unbelievable story here that's equal part tragedy, investigation, and justice system breakdown. Gilbert, welcome to the program. You've covered a lot of injustices in your career, but when a judge personally reached out to you and said, there's an innocent man over here in prison, that's not exactly an everyday email. I mean, what was it about this case beyond the jaw-dropping details that made you say, yeah, I want to look into this. I need to tell this story.
You know, the very first thing, and thanks for having me, Tony. This is really exciting for me. I think the very first thing is when that judge, you know, gave me that card and said, he wrote on the back, it said, Leo Schofield, not just wrongfully convicted, he's an innocent man. When I saw that, I was like, God, a judge is not supposed to be doing that. You know, like there's codes of ethics that they're supposed to maintain. And he's basically saying that, you know, a guy was framed. And he's in a Florida prison, and he can't live with it. And it's kind of like a whistleblower in effect. So, I mean, he had that credibility coming in, you know, a judge saying this. I'm always a little bit skeptical, even in, you know, especially Florida, right? You know, it's Florida. You've got a crazy judge too, right? You know?
Yeah.
But so like, I think we talked for a little while. I told him, you know, I had a project that I was working on. It's going to take me a little while. And he was very, you know, disappointed. I could feel it in his voice. And he said, just do me a favor, just read the trial transcript. And as a way to just sort of get him off the phone, to be honest with you, I read the trial transcript, which is, you know, It's a big ask. It's like 2,000 pages.
Sure.
You know? But I started and I was like, this is interesting. I'm seeing how the state is presenting its case. And I didn't even have to read halfway through it. I'm like, I don't think this guy's guilty. Like, they didn't prove that case. And I started going back to the judge asking more questions. And he goes, nah, now you're hooked. You can see it. It gets worse. And he started to tell me more things that had developed over the years. And at that point, I was like, all right, I'm really interested in this. I want to pursue this. It was, you know, a couple months later after reading all these documents. And then that's when I met Leo. He set it up so that I could meet Leo. And that's when it really, really sold. I spent 3 hours in prison with Leo talking about his case. And, you know, this guy was just open book, transparent as can be. Ask me anything. I've been through the worst. I have nothing to hide. My story never changes. I'm an innocent man. And when you hear that, it's almost like a movie script starting. But, you know, his story gets so strange that you cannot believe the things that happen in this case.
There's so much to unpack in this case. I've had a chance to break it down quite a bit here, and I wanted to actually do some pieces on it here now that I'm a little bit hooked into this now.
It is. It's hooking, yes.
I mean, you certainly, you know, it's such a crazy situation, and we have so many cases like this where justice is not served. It's not done correctly. Just because we got somebody behind bars does not mean you have the right person behind bars all the time. But communities, they like to kind of move on and think we got the right thing going on here. Let me ask you, was the judge that reached out to you, was he involved in this case at all? Or is he just kind of an observer on the sideline that just said, hey, somebody's got to look at this better?
That's what I thought originally. But he said, like, going back, like, I think it was like 15 years, he had been Leo's defense attorney for a very short period of time.
Okay.
And then he got appointed a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to leave Leo.
Yeah.
And he just always felt bad about that. And, he had a conversation with Leo. And Leo's like, you take that judgeship or I'm never talking to you again. Like, this is your opportunity. This is what you led your life. So he went on. But he always had it in the back of his mind, like, I didn't do enough for Leo. And I think he felt really guilty about that because the more he looked into it, the more convinced he was that he was innocent.
Gilbert, do you think that if he had not taken that judgeship, if he had stayed on as his attorney, it would have been a different outcome? Is that what he was feeling? And he had that guilt?
I think a little bit, but I don't think he felt like he could have changed it. I think they felt like they did everything possible. They got all this evidence, all this new evidence before judges in the same Polk County, and they were just shot down by the judges. And it was just so exhausting for him. He's like, anywhere else, this would be ruled on differently. But in this particular county, they had kind of stuck together. And a lot of the judges used to be prosecutors in the same office and as the prosecutor himself. And so there was kind of that, hometown cooking, I guess you'd want to say.
Yeah.
And that was what really upset him the most, that he just couldn't get justice in this county.
And it seems we see so much of that in smaller communities. It's like you don't want to be brought up on a crime in somewhere where they can kind of bury it and nobody's going to pay attention. There's less eyes on a lot of those communities.
Oh, that's exactly what happened in this case. You know, it wasn't a spectacular big case. It was just sort of seen as an open and shut case because they didn't have all the evidence and, you know, a lot of twists and turns along the way. But, you know, it wasn't really covered like it was a big trial. It seemed like almost like a slam dunk at the time. And I think you find a lot of wrongful conviction cases like that with the way they're covered in local media. You know, the prosecution has the voice.
So you know, go ahead, Stace.
Gilbert, you uncovered some things here. You changed the course of this man's life. Was there any pushback for you personally to keep your nose out of it?
Not anything like that's threatening to me. I mean, the state will say things like, oh, it's a very entertaining story, but, you know, the writer got fooled by this convicted murderer. I'm like, you know, I spent 6 years on this thing. I would have found out if I would have been fooled. You know, like it's just a ridiculous argument. So that's the only kind of pushback I get. Or the other thing is like, we don't try our cases in public opinion. We try them in the court where there's integrity. I'm like, you know, there's not actually more integrity in the courtrooms. A lot of times evidence is not allowed.
Yeah.
You miss deadlines. There's a lot of things. I don't necessarily see the truth coming out in court or with a verdict all the time. So I don't buy that argument either.
It feels like it's a lot of truth to power these days that gets things into the courtroom or gets things back into the courtroom now by journalists and podcasters, investigators just like yourself who are going, hey, this is not okay. And that seems to be the only way that sometimes things get where they need to go and for justice to be served. So give us some background here on what this is all about. Michelle Schofield, she's the one who vanished after a shift at a restaurant in Lakeland back in 1987. Her car found abandoned, her body found 3 days later. She's married to Leo Schofield. Before this even takes place, what kind of relationship was going on there? Was there any reason for people to think there was red flags, or was this just, you know, nobody really knew him very much, and then she's dead, so immediately everybody goes to the husband?
You know, it's interesting how it started, because Leo, from the start, is the one calling police constantly. My wife, I can't find her. And they're saying, well, you can't report her missing because she's 18 years old now. And you know, if we see her, well, we can only put out a BOLO report, but we can't treat it like a missing person and start this big search. And so Leo and his friends put together this search party, and this goes on for days. And Leo's at the forefront of it, and he's the one who's bothering the police all the time. So they kind of don't think he's the suspect. But then when they eventually find the body after 3 days, they start canvassing the neighborhood. And there's a witness across the street from Leo who says that they fought all the time. And on the night that Michelle disappeared, she saw Leo carrying something heavy that looked like a body and putting it into the back of a car and driving off. And she said it happened between 2:30 and 3 in the morning. And she was sure of that. The only problem is, Leo was across town in the company of witnesses at 2:30 and 3 a.m., including Michelle's father while she was searching for him. And also, he went to the police again. So he was accounted for at 2:30 and 3. So now you see the prosecutor come in and start to move the timeline a little bit with the witness. Like, maybe it was like 1:30 that you saw this. And it just gets massaged a lot by a very aggressive prosecutor and a very inept defense attorney, which we've all seen before.
Yeah.
And so Leo's convicted and sentenced to life in prison, but he's always maintained his innocence.
That's so this witness, who this neighbor who saw this man with this body, I'm assuming she kind of went to basically assumption mode and thought, oh, that's Leo taking the body. I mean, what do we know about the witness? Is this legit of what she saw? Like, did she see this? She just didn't really know the context of what she was seeing.
Come to find out that she had some problems with some mental health issues, and she was institutionalized and
okay.
delusions. Wow. So she wasn't a great witness, to be honest with you. And she's changed her story multiple times over the years. But what I was able to figure out by really studying the transcript and then talking to people is that she did see Leo carrying something heavy, but it was most likely an amplifier for his heavy metal band. Okay. And it was a week or two before Michelle went missing. And the reason we know this is that Alice Scott's the name of the witness, her sister-in-law lived right next door. And she told police, yes, I was with my sister-in-law right in the driveway. We saw this together and we saw him carry, and we kind of laughed about it. And that, what's Leo doing? What's he carrying to the truck? Like that kind of joke about it, which doesn't really fit because, first of all, Linda, the sister-in-law, said that, well, I didn't work that night. So I didn't come home late that night to see that. I saw the same thing Alice saw, but I saw it a week or two earlier. It wasn't the night Michelle disappeared. Mm-hmm. But Alice just sort of went with this story and decided to say it was that night. And then she said, I can't remember dates. She got very confused about it. But, you know, by that time, I think the prosecutor sort of already sealed his case with a lot of the bad character evidence that he opened the case with. And the defense attorney didn't do much to sort of set that clear that, like, Michelle was alive at the time that Leo, you know, was carrying something out heavy. It just became this one star witness who carried the day for the prosecutor. And the defense just like didn't do any preparation, didn't do any depositions, didn't do any investigation. So it was just a really bad time for Leo. He just got killed in the trial.
And this
feels like reasonable doubt. You've got somebody whose story keeps changing. Have you talked to anybody on the jury at all?
Yeah, I talked to them because it's Florida, right? And in the 1980s, most of the jury members were retired. So by the time we tried to reach them, they're mostly passed away. But we did find one woman who was 22 at the time, and she talked to us, and she basically said the quiet part out loud. She said, oh, I didn't think he was guilty, but I just went along with everybody else. Like she felt like the kid in the room. Right. But then when it came time for the death sentence, they all wanted to kill him. And she said, no, I don't want. And because of her age, I think they kind of said, all right, we'll just give him life in prison. And she said, I probably saved that guy's life. So it was a literally, strange, it was a strange interview.
How do we go from Leo has an alibi, including her father, the father of the victim, saying, yes, he was with us that night, to being tried for murder on the testimony of a person with mental health issues who is a kind of sketchy witness? I mean, where is the trigger here? I mean, I know it can go pretty quick in some of these police departments in small towns where there's not a lot of experience and they want to close the case and look like heroes, but walk me through that.
Well, I'll just tell you, this is one of those cases, and they're all different. And I look at them, you know, differently when I investigate. I didn't really see a lot of wrongdoing by the police. I mean, there was moments of incompetence,
sure,
but they did their job. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that by Alice Scott seeing Leo, carrying something heavy to the car, we know that Michelle was found 3 days later, stabbed 26 times. So it's presumed that she was stabbed inside the trailer. That's where she heard the fight happening. But there was no blood in the trailer. Like, not a single drop of blood was found. Mm-hmm. And so basically what it came down to, I think, was a really aggressive and effective prosecutor steamrolling an old-time country lawyer who didn't really understand science that well, couldn't remember names. It was just really inept in every way. It was just a matter of a prosecutor just really putting a beating on a defense attorney. There was nothing that the police really did wrong or unethical. I really made that very clear in my investigation. They had some moments where they should have probably seen a few things that would have really helped them a lot. But this was a case where just the prosecutor just made his case a circumstantial case. There's no physical evidence tying Leo to the crime. There's some weird things that happened in the trial. One of the things I think was one of the biggest things that hurt Leo was that on the third day of searching, they all break up. They found the car the night before, so they kind of knew how to trace it back to the last place she was seen. And the search party breaks up, and Leo's father ends up being the one that finds the body. And he says something afterward like, you know, God help me find her. And it got turned into this premonition, and it got spun into this premonition he had the night before that told him to search in this place. And none of that's on the record, but that's how it sort of manifested. So you have this weird father thing that the prosecutor was able to say, he's in on it. How would he know the body was there? He was in on it.
Oh, God.
So I think that made a big difference. It hurt Leo for sure.
Yeah. Stace, you have anything there?
Yeah. Not so much about what you just said, Gilbert, but something from the get-go, you mentioned Florida, and Florida has popped up in your work before.
A Florida man.
Yes.
No doubt.
Do you have any insight as to what the hell's going on in Florida? Why is this such fertile ground for you to have these insights and to be able to do what you're doing?
You know, I think about this a lot. One of the things I think that makes a big difference in Florida, it does have this kind of Wild West mentality that, you know, like people just tend to escape there. So like, where'd Ted Bundy go? Like, he ended up in Florida, right?
Yeah.
It's just this Wild West kind of, and I think part of that is still there. Like, people feel like they can get lost there. And you have a lot of transients, people coming from all over end up in Florida. Like Leo comes from like Boston, you know, the Fall River. And so he's got that thick Boston accent. And then he's down there with these country boys. And I don't know, it's just kind of this potpourri. I think the real thing is that, you know, it's the third largest state in the country. So there's a lot of people down there and a lot of stories. And I think basically just, you know, my connections with people, they point me in the right directions of some really galling stories. Sure. And that's pretty much my explanation. I'll also say, like, a lot of the stuff I did was in the pre-civil rights era, like in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And Florida was the most dangerous state to be black in. It had the highest per capita lynching rate in all of America.
Yeah.
And so Florida, people don't think of that.
No.
It's because it's not, you know, like one of those civil rights states like Louisiana, Mississippi. What's going on in Florida? People didn't really know what to think of it. And so the stories just didn't catch the attention of the public the way a story like this might in Mississippi or Alabama.
Context is so interesting with all of that, especially when we're talking historically and looking at cases and what was going on at the time, because all of that plays into it so much. Let me ask you this. You'd mentioned that Leo was in a heavy metal band, and we're talking 1987 at this point, where you also have like the satanic panic and things like that going on. People are thinking, you know, any hard rock music, it's the devil. Was that, did that play into to his conviction at all, you think? Just kind of, I don't know what he looked like at that moment in time, but, you know, people, yeah. If they had any idea that he's in a heavy metal band, you know, that could immediately go to, he's a bad guy, he's a Satanist, because there was such an easy switch to flip back in 1987.
He might have tattoos or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Like Leo at the time looked like, and we use him on the Bone Valley logo. Mm-hmm. That was the moment when he, they just found Michelle's body and he tore off his shirt. They wouldn't let him see her. Mm-hmm. And he was just really frustrated. He just kept pacing back and forth. I think he looked like kind of a young Freddie Mercury. He had that really long black hair.
Yeah.
So he was definitely.
Is him, I'm assuming, on the logo?
No, that's a guy I'm going to talk to you in a few minutes.
Okay, great.
Because that's season two.
This is season two. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But you'll see him. But he did have that look, and he was a lead guitarist, and he was a really talented guitarist. He played the role really well. The thing you see about the satanic panic was it showed up in a lot of police reports. And sometimes you read these witnesses and they're like, oh yes, he had a terrible temper and his eyes would turn red whenever he got mad.
It's
and
comical.
You know, that kind of stuff. And fortunately, it didn't make it into the trial. I think the prosecutor said, I don't even need that stuff.
Sure.
But he does show up there, you know, like he was a Satanist and like there's no evidence of that.
No.
People assumed it, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering just how much of the conjecture of the day, you know, in fact, did play into all of that of like, oh, you know, just your preconceived notions that every generation has. And it seems every 10 years or so there's another one. So there's no physical evidence that's tying Leo to the crime scene. It's all circumstantial. Obviously, if you have at the end of the day in a courtroom, it is about who's telling the best story. It's not always necessarily about fact or truth. Unfortunately, that's just kind of how it works. So how did the prosecution, you know, get this on him? How did they convince that jury? What was the, was there a linchpin to this that really pushed them over the edge to say, this is our guy and we're almost to the point of we're going to put him to death if it weren't for the 22-year-old on the jury?
Yeah, it basically came down to this. The state opened their case with 21 bad character witnesses and it was not objected to. So you had, you know, a parade of witnesses going, he's got the worst temper I've ever seen. He punches doors. He does this. He does that. There are some in there that were talking about, you know, like fights with Michelle, physical fights with Michelle. Mm-hmm. That would have been admissible. But a lot of the other stuff would not have been admissible. But because Leo's lawyer didn't know that and didn't object to it, it was never preserved. So they couldn't even appeal on that later on. And the prosecutor is supposed to file what's called a notice of intent saying, I'm going to do all these bad character witnesses. Usually the judge will step in and say, you can do one bad character witness on that topic. You don't need 10. But it was just overkill. And I've had a lot of like professors and prosecutors even read the transcript and they all come away the same thing. This trial was over with the first 2 days of just this endless parade. You just hated Leo by the end of this.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things. I think, you know, the other problem was Leo's defense was an alibi defense. He was with all these people. And I think the prosecutor narrowed it down to the time he was with Leo's father. And because Leo's father had found the body and he said this weird thing about God helping him or a vision from God that helped him find, he was able to destroy the credibility of Leo's alibi witness. And so that was what really the prosecutor leaned on, saying, you cannot believe a word this man says. He's nuts. And he's lying, obviously. He didn't hear from God, you know, like they used that against him. And so I think that was pretty much it. I mean, Leo ended up taking the stand. From the transcript, he answers the question solidly, seemed to be frustrating to the prosecutor, but he doesn't really come across very emotionally. The answers yes and no answers. And he just said, I didn't have any experience doing this. I'm fighting for my life. And so I just think it was a cumulative effect of just bad defense work and a really aggressive prosecutor who was able to weave together a circumstantial case that kind of made sense if you didn't look at it too closely.
Yeah. I mean, you just kind of get out there, you do it. And if you can make it sound right and tight and it makes sense, you can convince a jury. And again, we're talking 1987 too. So it's a little easier, I think, to go down that road than obviously with what we have today in terms of technology and such. So, so this is where it sits for such a long time. How long is he in prison before you end up kind of diving into this case? And was there anything else? Did anybody else dive into this in all of that time?
Yeah. And this is the fascinating part of the story. So Leo goes to prison, you know, he goes through his appeal, his direct appeal, he loses that. He's trying to settle into a life in prison. He's told by some older inmates, like, you got to make yourself useful in here. You dropped out of high school, go get your GED, maybe pursue some college degrees, which Leo does. He takes this seriously. He gets multiple college degrees. He becomes a pastor. But early in his prison, when he's in a few years, he gets assigned to be a teacher's aide to a social worker. And the social worker's name is Chrissy Carter. Mm-hmm. And she's this, like, imagine she's like a 30-year-old, tall, blonde social worker. And this is the hard part of the story to believe. They fall in love in the prison. Wow. And they get married. And they've been married for 30 years. This marriage is held. But Chrissy gets obsessed with the case, and she starts looking into it. She believes, you know, Leo doesn't push it. He says, look, I don't want to play games with you. I'm convicted of murdering my wife.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to look into it, look into it. I'll answer any question you have, but I'm still mourning that. And I'm wrongfully convicted. And she starts to believe him, and she starts going into the clerk's office and doing some research. And she becomes obsessed with the investigation herself. And she finds these fingerprints that were found in the car that Michelle was driving at the time that didn't match Leo. They didn't match Michelle. They didn't match anyone who should have been driving. They're just unidentified. And she gets obsessed with this for years. Like, why can't we identify these prints? And finally, she has a friend who's a detective in a nearby county, and she just begs her to run these prints just to see, just to satisfy the curiosity. And the detective, who's pretty skeptical herself at this time, says, fine, you know, I'll get you to shut up. I'll run the prints. They run the prints. A couple of days later, there's a match, and it comes back to a convicted killer who lives about a mile away from Leo and Michelle, was out of prison at the time, and he was right there living in this part of Polk County in Lakeland, and he's in prison now for another murder. In fact, it looks like he's killed a couple people in Polk County, but he wasn't in prison at the time of Michelle's murder. And so now they have these fingerprints that come back to a killer. And so this starts another level of appeals. This is new evidence. And then they go through an evidentiary hearing that happens. It's hard to imagine, but this is what happens in the concept of finality and, you know, prosecutors just kind of doubling down on their conviction. Leo doesn't get before another court for 5.5 years after those fingerprints are discovered. It's just slow walked and delayed and everything. And, you know, it just shows you, like, they didn't really have any intent on investigating, like, who this guy was, where he was at the time. It was more like, shut it down. Mm-hmm. And so they basically send a couple cold case detectives there. The guy's name is Jeremy Scott. And, you know, he's panicked when this happens because, you know, he's realizing, oh, they could maybe send me to death row. He says, well, you know, maybe is the stereo missing? He says that, you know, is the car stereo missing? And in fact, it was. Somebody had broken in. So he goes, that's why my fingerprints are in there. I used to be a car stereo thief.
How interesting.
And so that And that actually carries the day. A judge believes that, you know, he's just a car stereo thief. He's not a killer, basically. It's what he's in prison for. In fact, this office charged him twice for murder. But they just go, oh, he just had the bad luck of breaking into a car of a girl who was killed, you know, an hour earlier. And so because he denied it, that was it. And that was the end of things. And then something else happens about 10 years later. That's just another remarkable thing.
Stacey, you have any questions right now?
I'm stunned. First of all, a social worker that would fall in love with somebody who's convicted of killing his wife. That's a leap, you know, that's an absolute leap because she knows who she deals with on a daily basis. I know somebody who works with people who are in prison as a therapist, and it's really grueling work and you have to constantly be on your guard. So to let that guard down and fall in love with somebody who is convicted of killing a spouse, that's gutsy.
I mean, it had to be problematic too, because it's a third degree felony to, and so she had to Leo had to put in for a transfer to another prison so that she could visit him, because she couldn't work in the same prison if they're going to have a relationship. And they did that. And, you know, this relationship, I mean, they actually ended up adopting a daughter at one point, 22 years ago, together. And, you know, they're still a family together today.
How did that work? Adopting a daughter? Well, he's in prison, right? So,
I mean, yeah.
So it was like, let's go visit dad in prison. I mean, it's a weird, I've never heard of that, but that's an interesting setup. But she believes in his innocence 100% that this is how it works.
Right. Well, you know, it's just one of those things, like, it's Leo being Leo and who they are as people. I've gotten to know them really well. So there was a pregnant wife of an inmate who was saying that, you know, she had her kids in foster care and she's got another child coming. She can't care for it.
Yeah.
And so Chrissy and Leo said, we can care for it. And so they formally adopted her, like, when she was seven. But Leo held her in his arms at 4 days old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're extremely close today.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable story.
It is.
But, you know, this inmate ended up getting out and getting shot dead. And so it was from a troubled family. And Leo and Chrissy came in and took, you know, Ashley and raised her ever since. And,
that's amazing. You know, wow.
So it just really speaks to the character of them. And I've gotten to know them really well. And, you know, the thing about it is, like, I just described to you a case that, you know, like, you could go either way, right? Like, there's, like, evidence of, you know, Leo carrying something out, a jury believed it, the appellate courts believed it. And I almost feel like that part of the story is, like, inconsequential, because what happens after the fingerprints are discovered is that Jeremy Scott claims that the prosecutor told him in a closed door meeting with no witnesses, no police, and no tape recorder, stick to the story of the stereo theft. Say you did that. And just stick with that story. I'll help you with your parole. And so Jeremy was like, okay, I've heard a state attorney's helping with parole. I'm going to do that. But then the prosecutor doesn't do anything. And then he passes away. And Jeremy gets upset about this.
Yeah.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino, with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including Live Dealer, Blackjack, and Craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Bretzky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend, because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com, SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.